All right, so as I say, lesson number six, question number eight, we had talked about all of the various types of sacrifices that they would make at the altar of burnt offering. And the last question before this one was asking about unintentional sins and also something that may not necessarily come out right away is the sin offerings. When we talk about those are offered for unintentional sins. But then as we move in here to question number eight, what is the offering for an intentional sin, for a presumptuous sin, according to Numbers chapter 15, verses 30 and 31? Yeah, there was none. And then Stephen?
Yourself.
Yeah, it was your life. That's exactly right. There is no sacrifice. There was no animal that you could give in order to atone for a sin that you committed defiantly. Kevin.
Hebrews 10:26, the new law. For if we sin willfully after we receive the truth and the knowledge of the truth, there remains no more sacrifice for sins.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. What was the verse reference again? Hebrews 10:26. If we sin willfully after we've come to the knowledge of the truth, no more sacrifice for sin. Yeah, that's right. So the New Testament is consistent in this. And so then what is left? If someone is going to be spared the death penalty, how's the only way that comes about?
Direct appeal to God's mercy.
You know, think, classic example is David, right? He clearly did what he did, not only in lying with Bathsheba, but working to cover it up and then bringing about the death of Uriah, all of that clearly done on purpose, defiantly, and then he threw himself at God's mercy when he admitted his sin. And Nathan tells him, "Your sin has been put away from you; you shall not die." But again, this is not something. I think Kevin bringing out the verse in Hebrews helps to make this point. Just because the blood of Jesus can atone for an intentional sin does not mean that it is something that we ought to take lightly. I think that the fact that there was no offering for an intentional sin under the old law ought to give us great pause. You know, we might come to our senses later, but again, we ought to realize the mercy that God is extending us when He forgives us for a sin that we commit presumptuously or defiantly.
Obviously, the 10:26 first part says, "You go on." Willfully. It's not describing a situation where someone has sinned willfully and regrets and repents, but
right,
there's somebody who is willfully pursuing, which is the example of David. He did persist in willful sin and then repented. And so to the Hebrews, if you continue down the path you're on, there's nothing that can save you from that.
Right.
Except coming away from that path.
Yeah. Good point. So moving on to question number nine, the Lord demanded the firstborn males and beasts be offered. So what offering did He demand for them, and why? This is one of those times where we're not always given an explicit why, but we're given an explicit why here. So what offering did He demand for the firstborn males of both beast and man? I should say, by the way, we're moving away from what you might call I don't want to say that these are not formal, they're formal offerings, but we're moving away from offerings that you associate strictly with the work of the tabernacle. There, we're moving away from sin offering, burnt offering, peace offering, that sort of thing, to talk about some first fruits offering. So, what was the offering for the firstborn of both beast and man? They belong to the Lord. Okay. All right.
Man and beast and produce.
Mm-hmm.
And, the reason for it was because it goes back to Egypt. And because of the firstborn was killed. I think that is what is stated, but also you think the Israelites being spared, the firstborn, had something to do with that also.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. So if I've got a cow who this is her firstborn of her offspring, I offer that I offer that that cow. I offer the offspring of sheep. What about a donkey? What was the if you had a donkey and the first of its issue? What was that? What were they to do in that case? Yeah, redeem the donkey with a lamb. So there were certain things that you could not. Yes, God claimed it, but He said, "I don't want that. I want something else." Or, as He says, break its neck. But we can't really do that with men, and so again, we redeem man the same way that we would redeem a donkey, offer a lamb. But again, the picture is God says, "I claim this firstborn, and so you have to offer me something in order to take him back," as it were. And Tony hit on something else there too. Why? Well, we get an explicit reason there. We had God in back when they were in Exodus, slaying all of the firstborn of the Egyptians, and by doing that, He claimed the firstborn as His own. Take a look at Exodus 13, verses 14 and 15. So when they're doing this in the future, Moses says, "When your son asks you in time to come, 'What is this?' you'll say to him, 'By strength of hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And it came to pass when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, that the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord all males that open the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem." So it's twofold. Yes, there's a first fruits aspect of it. This idea that, well, I will give to God the first as an act of faith that He will provide more to come. But it's also a memorial at the same time. I like these things where there's a mixture. It's not just one thing. There are supposed to be a couple of things at least that come to mind with this first, when you offer your first fruits and when you redeem the firstborn. Yes, it's an act of faith, but also remember where this comes from. Remember that you were a people enslaved in Egypt, and the Lord delivered you from that bondage. Kevin. Right. Yeah, that's a good point. So let me take that and run with it. When you think about how do you go from a generation that is so faithful in Joshua's day to a generation that apparently in just a single generation's time leaves the Lord completely? How does that happen? Your Uncle Bob has posited, well, can you imagine somebody in that situation? Why are we doing this? Hey, listen, we gotta hurry up and get down to Jerusalem. I'll explain it to you later. God said to that. That's why. When the parents don't stop, I think this was in that same conversation. He made this same statement. He said, "Impress upon your children what impresses you about God." When parents don't stop and take time to say, "Here's why this is special. And here's why we take time to do this. This is why this is important. This is why we can't forget this." Then you end up with a generation that knows not God, like in the Judges. So good point, Kevin. Let's see. So this is going to sound familiar. We had some things that would keep someone from serving as a priest, even though he was in the line of Aaron. Well, what were some things that God said, "I want you to offer things to me in sacrifice, but not these"? What were some things that he rejected as offerings? This is Leviticus 22:17 through 33.
Blindness, scab, broken root, mm-hmm. any imperfection, basically, in that animal.
Yeah, exactly. And any imperfection, we could just sum it up in that way. But of course, he gives us a number of examples, as you've just mentioned. I think it's interesting that if the defect was that one limb was too long or one limb was too short, he said, "You can't offer that to me, generally speaking." But he says in verse 23, if it's a free will offering. So recall that there are certain offerings that say if the high priest sins, he has to offer a bull. At Passover, you have to offer a lamb. So there are certain offerings that God says, "You will make this offering." But if I just decide, I'd like to make an offering to God, He says, "Okay, if its leg's a little long, that's fine, because you're going above and beyond." Now, there was another prohibition there that I thought was interesting. Look at verse 25. Anything from a foreigner's hand, because their corruption is in them. So here again, God's not a racist, but he's saying, I want the distinction between me as the holy God, the Lord, to be so different from the unholy gods in the nations round about. I don't even want you offering something that you got from one of those people, not because of their blood, but because of their practices. So he doesn't want to have anything to do with that. A couple of other things, the last couple of verses there, if it's younger than 8 days. You can offer it once it's 8 days old and older, but not if it's younger than 8 days. And also don't offer a mother and her offspring on the same day. And then finally, question number 11, the tithe. What was subject to the tithe? Oh, go ahead, Tony. I'm sorry.
I think the concept of sacrifice comes into play here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just what am I willing to get rid of, like donating my clothes to Goodwill. You know, I take stuff I'd never wear again anyway, and I might take it. But here he's wanting you to sacrifice something that means something to you, just like David said, I will not give or I will not offer something that costs me nothing.
Yeah, I like that one. I will not offer something that costs me nothing. Yeah.
I want it to hurt. I want it to be a sacrifice, an actual offering to the Lord, so He knows that I've got skin in this game. This did cost me something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's interesting too the fact that we see all these other things listed that disqualify this animal from being a sacrifice. But then we have the one where he says, okay, if it's a free will offering, you can offer this. Was that sheep that has a leg that's a little bit long? Was that going to be of no use at all? No, there was some use you could get out of that. Whereas if it's sick, if it's got a broken leg, I mean, there's not really any use. You're not, as you say, you're not really losing anything by offering that to the Lord. It's not an offering. It's a cast off. Anything else then before we move on to talk about the tithe? So question 11, what was subject to the tithe? This is Leviticus 27, 30 through 33. Yeah, the picture, in fact, it I probably should have the passage in front of me where it uses this language, but the picture is when you go to offer a tithe of your livestock, just have them sort of walk in front of you and count them off with a rod. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. This is the tenth when it goes to the Lord. And so the point you make about it, he is not, with regard to the tithe, as concerned with absolute perfection. Just take every tenth, and that's what goes to, that's what you offer as the tithe. Now, it's interesting, too. Crops were allowed to be redeemed, so I don't know, maybe for some reason you really need corn instead of wheat. Well, instead of offering a tenth of your corn, you could offer the same amount of wheat plus one-fifth and be able to retain that. Now, the tithe, of course, went to the Levites. And I also mentioned, too, that there was a second tithe. This is over in Deuteronomy. It's mentioned a couple of places. Deuteronomy 14, verses 22 through 29, and 26, verses 12 through 14. The first tithe that we were just talking about went to the Levites, according to Numbers 18. But the second tithe only involved crops, according to Deuteronomy 14:22, and it was to be brought to the tabernacle. And the offerers also ate of it. So it's almost a commanded potluck. You're going to take this portion of this tithe, and you are going to come and you're going to enjoy that as well as the Levites. So they ate of it and invited the Levites to join in. But then every third year, and this is in Deuteronomy 14:28 and 29, every third year they were to store up this second tithe in their gates, in their cities, and that was to provide not only for the Levite, but also the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. And again, that's Deuteronomy 14, verses 28 and 29. And finally, I know we touched on this already when we were talking about redeeming the firstborn of both man and beast. Tony mentioned first fruits. Once they entered the land, they were supposed to offer the first fruits of their grain, oil, wine, and fruit, and that went to the priest and their families. That's Numbers 15, verses 17 through 21, and chapter 18, verses 12 and 13. Now, there was a special rule about fruit trees. If they planted fruit trees, they were not to either eat or offer that fruit the first 3 years. And then the fourth year, anything that they, any increase that they got or produce that they got from that tree, that went to the Lord. And then finally, in the fifth year, then you could eat of it yourself. Of course, after offering first fruits and a tithe from it. Oh, and one more thing about the tithe, right quick. I had been under the misimpression in time past, and I've heard other people say it too, that the tithe was not what we might call a wealth tax. In other words, the tithe was not take everything you own and now 10%. It was of your increase. The tithe, so it was an income tax. It was not a wealth tax, if you use modern terminology for that sort of thing. But if for some reason you did not, if I'm reading it correctly, if for some reason you did not enjoy any increase, then it appears to me that the Lord would not require of you a tithe. This was only of your increase. That's not to say that other offerings were not required, but the tithe appears to be only on increase and not all of one's wealth.
When you say increase, you mean income.
Yes. So if you harvest a crop, but if for some reason the entire crop failed, you don't have anything to give. You did not enjoy any increase that year. And so I don't think that you would be required to pay a tithe of it because you don't have anything to pay a tithe from. Okay, so that's the end of lesson number 6. Any questions or comments about the sacrifices and offerings before we move on into lesson number 7?
Just briefly, and I think Kevin mentioned when he comes to the New Testament, this, all of these offerings have they are a shadow of things to come in the New Testament.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is an offering of thanksgiving, or it is a sin offering, or it is a trespass offering, or a burnt offering that is a complete offering.
Mm-hmm.
All of those are a shadow, and they have their reality in the New Covenant.
Absolutely.
So it has many things that we're going to come across in the Pentateuch there. They have the reality in the New Testament.
Yeah, I suppose if we're gonna say let's just take the burnt offering, the sin offering, and the peace offering. What in the New Testament, what or who is the sin offering? Jesus, yeah, Christ. Who is the Passover or the peace offering? Christ, the Lord's Supper, the only thing that can be picturing is that peace offering meal that we have with God because we now have fellowship. Who though is the burnt offering? Yeah, Romans 12, right? You know, it's a living sacrifice. So I'm the burnt offering. I'm the one who has to give of my whole self to the Lord. Jesus has atoned for us. He has brought us back into fellowship, but now it's my turn to give of myself entirely to the Lord. So yes, good point about all these things having shadows or fulfillment in the New Testament. I should say they are shadows in the Old Testament; they are fulfilled in the New Testament. All righty, lesson 7. So we have talked about the tabernacle. We have talked about the priests and their regalia and their duties. And now we've talked about the sacrifices and offerings. And so now as we move into lesson 7 and actually see the Levitical priesthood begin, we sort of have I thought this was a nice time to introduce the narrative again because we've got a background. All that stuff that we see talked about in Leviticus 8, 9, and 10. We know what that stuff is now. Whereas lots of times we'll come to Leviticus 10, for instance, and not necessarily have taken time to set up all that context. So now you've got all those details loaded into your mind, and you go on Jeopardy, and Ken Jennings says, "Well, this is the only sacrifice that had leaven accompanying it," and you could say, "Oh, it was a peace offering with thanksgiving," and you know all that, right? So you got all those details loaded in your mind. Now we can move into Leviticus 8, 9, and 10, and we know what in the world they're talking about here. And there, by the way, there are a couple of details, and I'll mention one here in a little bit. But there are a couple of details. If you don't have the background, you might misunderstand what Moses is getting at in one point when he comes to correct Eleazar and Ithamar for not eating the sacrifice of the sin offering. So, having said that, our questions pick up in chapter 9, but chapter 8, that is, I mean, we studied the process of consecration of the priests, the high priest and the other priests, and that's chapter 8 in Leviticus. But as we move into chapter 9, it begins this way. It came to pass on the eighth day. So remember that consecration process took a full week, and then on the eighth day, that was when they could begin their work as priests. And that's what we see in real time, as it were, as we move into Leviticus chapter 9. So turn over, if you're not there, to Leviticus chapter 9, because that's where 9 and 10 is where this lesson comes from. So after undergoing this consecration process, what sacrifices did Aaron offer as he began his tenure as high priest? Moving into chapter 9 there.
He had to offer a calf and a bull, sin offering, and a ram for burnt offering.
Okay. So he offered those for himself. What did he offer for the people?
Peace offerings.
Bull and ram is for peace offerings. Now, if you're, again, I know you've got all these details loaded in your head, and so you're thinking, wait a second, I'm doing a diff between this and chapter 4 in Leviticus, and this looks a little bit different. I don't know why it's a little bit different, because he pretty clearly says that if the anointed priest sins, or if the congregation sins as a whole, then they're supposed to bring their blood into the, bring the blood of the offering into the tabernacle. And Aaron does not, at least it doesn't explicitly say that he does that. So this, I had always looked at these sin offerings as, because Moses says you're going to make these to atone for yourself and for the people. I had always looked at these as, well, you know, they're following in the same pattern. But apparently they follow a slightly different pattern here as this, in this inaugural day, if you will, of Aaron and his sons serving as priests. The details look a little bit different. Unless where it says in chapter 9, verse 9, he dipped his finger in the blood and put it on the horns of the altar. I'm reading that as the altar of burnt offering, not the altar of incense. But unless it's just assumed, hey, you've already read about sin offerings, and so you're supposed to understand that he had walked into the tabernacle and put that on the altar, the horns of the altar of incense. I don't think that's what's going on. And so all I can tell you is why the variation? Well, this is what the Lord commanded. They did hear what the Lord commanded as they began this first day of work. Now, here, we've observed how we have a number of fulfillments in the New Testament, right? Well, here we have Aaron as a shadow of Christ, and lots of times we talk about that in the way that Aaron looks. He's similar to Christ in some way, but here we have a contrast. What is the contrast between Aaron, even after he's undergone the consecration process, what is the contrast between him and Christ? This first day of service.
Still necessary for him to atone for himself.
Atone for himself and for the people. Look at, this is chapter 9, verse 7. Go to the altar, offer your sin offering and your burnt offering, and make atonement for yourself and for the people. So he's having to make atonement for himself. And obviously, we go over to Hebrews chapter 7, verse 27. Jesus does not need daily, as those high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for the people's. But he did this once for all when he offered up himself. So here, got a lot of similarities, got a lot of ways where these things look a lot like things in the New Testament, but here's a very notable contrast. Number two here, how did the Lord then, so here Aaron has offered these things on the altar, how did the Lord show his approval for what Aaron had been doing and for the sacrifices that he offered for himself and for the people? He appeared to all the people, and then what did he do after that?
Fire came down.
So now you said fire came down, and that may be a difference in translation. So it might, yeah, all I'm doing is trying to, because I know for a number of years I would think, well, this fire, this is Mount Carmel, right? Fire comes down from heaven and consumes the stuff on the altar. But the way it talks about the glory of the Lord appearing there in the tabernacle, or at the tabernacle, and then fire coming out from the Lord, I see it as more of, as if it's coming out from the direction of the tabernacle in order to consume all these things on the altar. In fact, what had happened is he and Moses had gone into the tabernacle, and then they both came out of the tabernacle, and Aaron raised his hands and blessed the people, and that was the point where God consumed those things on the altar. So it sounds as if somehow fire came out from the Lord, whether that was down from heaven or coming out from the direction of the tabernacle there. But then we have, again, lots of times we go to Leviticus 10 as, I don't want to say we pluck it out of context, but we haven't gotten a running start into Leviticus 10 to set the scene. But this was the very last thing that happened before Leviticus 10. Moses and Aaron came out of the tabernacle, Aaron blessed the people, and the Lord consumed with fire that came directly out from him, consumed the sacrifices on the altar. And then what happens in Leviticus 10, verse 1? Yeah, Nadab and Abihu, and they do what?
They offered fire that he did not command them. And as contrast to the consuming, it appears that he killed them, but there were still remains.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
That had to be carried out with the use of the poke or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That would carry them away and outside the camp, if I remember.
Yes, that's correct. So that was a contrast that didn't dawn on me to bring out, but that's interesting. So the Lord consumes totally the sacrifices on the altar, but he burns with fire. Fire comes out from the Lord because of this strange or profane fire that they offered, but he does not entirely consume them, but he kills them, but we still have their remains and they have to be carried out by their tunics there, I think it's Aaron's nephews. Yes, sir.
Just pondering through the centuries and millennium, people who claim to have gotten a revelation from God, there's a difference between some guy saying this came from God and 2 million people witnessing a miracle. There's a little bit of confirmation there.
Yeah, in fact, I skipped that part, but yeah, this happens. The Lord consumes the altar sacrifices, and then all the people shout and fall to their faces. So, yeah, good point. They witnessed this. They saw this. This is one of those things you can't really replicate or fake.
And along that same line, you have those same people watching their brothers carry them out,
mm-hmm.
and as a witness to the fact that God says, "I'm holy, and you have to be holy in front of me."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they witness God saying, "I absolutely approve of this, and I strongly disapprove of this," all in the space of a breath, it seems like, at the very least, a very few heartbeats.
I know you've built up, and just to reiterate, I wonder if the chapter 8 and 9 procedure may be the sacrifice on the altar externally. And that there has to be a process of atoning before even the high priest can enter in to the tabernacle. In other words, yes, that's the normal procedure, mm-hmm. after this initial, you can't even go in there until you've taken care of this out here. And so even the high priest has to go through a procedure to be cleansed to enter into the tabernacle. And all of that just to say that so much effort has been put into the communication of the holiness of God. So that chapter 10 ought to be that major contrast, instead of taken by itself, taken built upon this contrast of ever-increasing communication of God's holiness and then disregard,
mm-hmm.
of God's holiness.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's flying in the face of a lot.
Yeah, you know, all of this very clear communication that, nope, not yet. You got to be cleansed for a week. Nope, not yet. You even have to offer some more sacrifices before you can take up this duty, and then for Nadab and Abihu to do what they do. And as Leonard put it, notice the language. We've seen this already earlier in our studies, but notice the language in Leviticus 10, verse 1. Offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them, not which he forbade them to offer, but he did not give them a positive command. We'll talk about this some more in a moment, but I don't think that language is by accident. Moses wasn't just waxing eloquent there. He uses those words very specifically, or very intentionally, I should say.
And if they would disregard it here, with the fire still in the mountain, as far as we can tell, there's They're still at Mount Sinai.
The fire's still on the mountain, and the glory of the Lord's still right there in front of them on the tabernacle.
Then what does that,
So we've gotten into, Leonard jumped ahead, got to question number four here. We talked about what the Lord did in punishing them. We've also touched on why. You know, why did he punish them so harshly? Because they did not, as it says in verse 3, you get the impression that Aaron is about to object, and Moses says, hang on. And he says, by those who come near me. This is what the Lord spoke. By those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy. And before all the people, I must be glorified. And Nadab and Abihu, by doing something which the Lord, not by doing something that the Lord had forbidden them to do, had expressly forbidden them to do, but by doing something that the Lord did not ask for. I think it's critical that we understand that. The Lord says, you are not regarding me as holy, and you will pay with your lives. Kevin.
I get more evidence that even if someone were to come back from the dead, that would not convince the stubborn. Here is the glory of the Lord appearing in the tabernacle, showing a miracle. And like Steve said, just immediately, while it's still there, people say, oh, Jesus has just appeared to me, I believe it. Mm-hmm. Jesus talked to me, I believe it. There are people to whom a preponderance of evidence will never change their mind.
Yeah.
And that's why Jesus can say, no, you got the law and the prophets, that's all that is. That's not going to do it, nothing's going to do it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good point.
I find it interesting that when Moses speaks to Aaron, he said, he didn't say, this is what the Lord said, they didn't obey me. He said, I will be glorified. I will be sanctified before the people. That's why this happened. So hold your peace.
And he held his peace. Yeah. Well, so this is obviously one of those occasions in which we are tempted to think, oof, seems kind of harsh. Did God overdo it here? So let me just remind you of a couple of passages. Romans 9, Paul says, what shall we say then? This is verse 14 and also verse 20. Is there unrighteousness with God? Certainly not. But indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? So I know Paul is making this argument in a certain context, but I think it's the attitude that we have to have. Whatever God did, he was righteous and just and holy. And again, from John, 1 John 5, last part of that verse. God is light, in him is no darkness at all. So whatever God did, it was not out of darkness. What God did here, it was out of light. So then, let's think about the punishment here. Stephen's already mentioned it. They didn't really take, even with the manifestation of the Lord there in front of them, they did not really take God seriously. They did not maintain holiness before him. The Lord gave them a special privilege in being priests. And they clearly did not consider the gravity of that honor. And so not unlike Esau, you know, they took a holy thing and they considered it, they treated it as profane. Now, I suppose you could ask Nadab and Abihu, if you 10 seconds before this, is the Lord holy above anyone or anything else? And they would have said, oh, of course. And if you'd ask, is this a priceless honor and privilege to serve as a priest? They would have said, oh, absolutely. And yet, here, what their actions evince is that they considered it a common or profane thing. They did not consider it a holy enough thing to say, wait a second. Is this something that's going to please God if I do this? I know what he's told me will please him. Is this going to please him? If they had just taken 30 seconds to stop and consider that, I think this story could have ended differently. And so then, do we, as Christians, part of the priesthood of believers, of all believers, right? Do we consider our place before God as part of that priesthood? Do we consider that a holy honor? Or do we consider it, do we treat it as a profane thing? What does your life say about that? Does your life betray that, I don't really consider it to be such a great honor? Or does your life portray to others, I consider it a profound honor that God has shown me the grace and the mercy to allow me to stand before him and to be one of his children and to serve in his in his priestly order, the order of Melchizedek, the order of Jesus Christ, the order of the Most High God. Aaron, again, another thing that we've touched on here, Aaron and his two still living sons forbidden to uncover their heads and tear their clothing or leave the tabernacle. Why was that? What specific information does Moses give us in verses 6 and 7? Say that again. Yes, they were. He says, the anointing oil is upon you. And of course, he says, lest you die. But he says in verse 6 there, let your brethren, the whole house of Israel, bewail the burning which the Lord has kindled. You shall not go out from the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die, for the anointing oil of the Lord is upon you. So I think what we have here is, well, number one, recall that the priests were not allowed to defile themselves for just anybody, right? But the non-high priests, they could defile themselves for the dead if it was a brother. And so we have Eleazar and Ithamar. Their two brothers are lying dead there. Why were they not allowed to defile themselves? We understand why the high priest would not be able to, but why were they not allowed to defile themselves? And I dare say that part of this is, here you have, again, on the first day of their service as priests, here you have Nadab and Abihu who have done something that has cost them their lives. And so if Aaron and his two remaining sons begin to, you know, they tear their clothes or they cut themselves or they do anything to cry out in mourning for their lost sons or brothers, then we have them who are the representatives of God here before the people doing something that seems to undermine God's judgment that he's just executed. So I imagine that is part of what's playing into this. We can pick up and talk some more about that on Wednesday. Well, who am I to say? Maybe we'll finish lesson 7 on Wednesday and get into lesson 8. I'd say at least do the first half or so of lesson 8 just in case. But there's still quite a bit more to talk about here in Leviticus 10. So we'll pick up with, finish up question 5 and then move into question 6 on Wednesday. Thank you for your comments and attention.